Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me today is our landlord and king of the castle, Ben Carter. Ben, how are you today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, I'm so glad you're able to join us. For people who don't know, we record this podcast in the Smoketown neighborhood in Louisville in a building that is owned by Ben. He's a good friend from way back. And I'm glad you're finally able to join us on a podcast with Jasmine out this week.
Yeah, I feel like I've eavesdropped enough and walked through your recordings with a weed whacker or something enough that now I get to sit behind the mic at least once.
Yeah, it's gonna be a good show. We're gonna talk about a couple things. We have some stuff about Reggie Thomas, who is a candidate in the 6th District. We're gonna talk about Andy Beshear, as per usual. Maybe we'll touch on some of the stuff that's going on with U of L and its implications on the state budget and some of the state's accounts. And then Ben has a couple of rants to take us on. So are you ready to talk about all these things, Ben?
I have watched the video. I've read the news articles.
Excellent.
I'm ready to go.
All right. Awesome. Okay. Reggie Thomas. Reggie Thomas is a state senator and a candidate for the 6th District United States congressional seat in Kentucky. That's Central Kentucky, Lexington area. This week, he released a campaign video entitled "We'll See." In terms of structure, it starts by talking about issues and ends with some biographical stuff. In the middle, he takes a shot at Lieutenant Colonel Amy McGrath, his opponent in the Democratic primary. The prevailing wisdom seems to think that Reggie Thomas is the underdog in this race, as his opponent, Lieutenant Colonel McGrath, she seems to have more support staff already and the ability to raise more money. He seems to be leaning into this state of affairs, though, just based on what we were able to see in this ad. He's emphasizing his roots in Kentucky and his long-term fight in the public sector, which differentiates him from McGrath, who spent a long time in the military and was all over the place. Grew up in Kentucky, though, spent some time in California, spent some time in D.C., but now she's here running for Congress, and Reggie says, "I've been here the whole time." So, Ben, my question for you, does this kind of campaign stand a chance of winning next year in 2018, this kind of like underdog type campaign?
Reggie's campaign?
Yeah, Reggie.
I think they're both good candidates.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that having two good candidates in the primary is only going to help whoever emerges, because I don't know Colonel McGrath, but it would behoove her, if she were to lose, to get behind Reggie in a big way and unite the party. And it's going to take a united and mobilized Democratic Party to beat Andy Barr. Mm-hmm. So I think Reggie has a shot for sure. Speaking of shots, what did you think about the fighter jet, you know, sort of screeching across the ad halfway through? It was like a record skip or something.
Well, I'll tell you exactly what I thought when I saw that, which I immediately understood what was going on there. I thought it was a little early to start taking shots like that, but I guess when you're campaigning like this, when you're kind of the underdog starting out behind or with, you know, maybe behind, that's at least what it appears to be he's trying to say, you know, this is kind of where you start. But I was wondering if, like, people are going to understand what that means. You know, if you're watching the video, you're going to be like, why is there a fighter jet in the middle of here if you don't know who Lieutenant Colonel McGrath is? You know what I mean?
He doesn't mention her by name.
No, he doesn't. He does, like, immediately say the thing that you say after the plane screeches across the screen is he says, there's a lot of stuff you can't see from a plane.
Yes.
Which, you know, well, you know, Lieutenant Colonel McGrath has done some really awesome stuff regarding planes. I mean, if you're going to try to take her on a plane campaign, she's probably going to win because she was, what, like the first female fighter pilot and stuff like that. So, you know, pretty impressive person. But, you know, I think he's just trying to emphasize his roots in Kentucky and how long he's been here fighting for people in Kentucky, right? Which gives me a little pause. And I think that maybe that's what he's trying to draw out is, like, if he was to win, you know, what's keeping her here? Which I think is a good reason why you might want to vote for him in the first place, right?
Yeah. I don't know how effective, now that we're talking about it, I don't know how effective including the actual visual of a fighter jet was. I think you can make your point in that ad by saying, you know, there's a lot you can miss
from a plane.
From a plane.
Right, absolutely.
Or you could say, or you could just emphasize the fact that you've been here the whole time and your actual work. I sort of agree that it might be a little too early to start trying to differentiate yourself that specifically.
Well, I do think that he's doing it on purpose. Like, I think he has a sense of how this race is going and what she's going to be able to do. And I think he kind of feels like to win, he's going to have to run a campaign like this. Which, I mean, there's good ways to do this and bad ways to do this. And I think the good ways to do this are to differentiate yourself from your opponent, attack them for things that are fair and above ground, but be able to endorse them later. But at the same time, that is, there are bad ways to do it. So, I mean, I think we're all hoping it doesn't roll into that.
I have a question for you. Amy McGrath appeared on CNN. Did you see that appearance?
I did not. What did she say? Did she have anything interesting to say?
I, I think that she would not commit to a single payer healthcare plan,
which
and,
he did,
and which he did, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Well, he's definitely running to her left, I think, on a lot of issues, and I think a lot of people that were further left than I think on the left part of the Democratic Party were a little turned off by the militarism in her video. But I mean, that's what she has to run on. She's a military person. She has a long record of service. She's flown combat missions, and that's something that I think that is compelling about her biography, that has been successful in campaigns in the past. But yeah, I think that that turned some people off, and he sees that as an opening, right, to kind of be like, you know, I'm not a fighter pilot. I haven't, you know, fought in a war, or I'm not a militaristic type person. But yeah, I think he's certainly running to her left, which is going to be interesting for the general election. I don't really know what would happen. People kind of think Andy Barr, I think that there's this emerging prevailing wisdom that, like, oh, everybody thinks Andy Barr is this bad candidate, but he's won three times in a row. Maybe he's better than we thought. Maybe he's even undefeatable. But if you look at the candidates that have run against Andy Barr, or since he defeated Ben Chandler when he was first elected, none of them were, I don't know what the best word is. Too serious? Is that a word?
They weren't able to raise the money that they needed to run to compete effectively.
Right. And if that's the piece of wisdom that's coming away from there, I think that that's a compelling reason to vote for Amy McGrath. Do you think that? But Reggie Thomas, you know, he is a state senator. He's been able to win elections in the past, which is different from the two people that ran in this district before. So do you think that he would be able to raise at least enough money to be competitive?
I think this is why I think crowded primaries are so good for Democratic politics, because you look at what happened here in Louisville recently with a crowded primary to replace Tom Owen as the Highlands Metro Council person. You really had a number of candidates running on different theories of what works in campaigns.
Sure.
Right? You had people knocking on doors. You had people raising a bunch of money. You had people getting Courier Journal endorsements. And
who got the Courier endorsement in that race? See, maybe it wasn't as effective as we thought.
I can't remember
me
who
either.
Got it.
Yeah.
And it was the same with Bill Hollander's campaign.
Sure.
He did not get the Courier Journal's endorsement.
No,
somebody
yeah.
else
But he got the mayor's endorsement.
And he got the mayor's endorsement. So it was like...
But here's one thing I'll say about that, though. They didn't have a general election to run in either the 8th or the 9th district in Metro Council. Like, they didn't have a Republican that they were... Oh, well, they might have in the 9th. I don't remember. But in the 8th, there was no Republican opposition.
But my point is this. Like, in the 6th district, we're going to have a really good test of what actually works. Amy McGrath has no geographical roots. Mm-hmm. She has not been a party player for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I met Reggie when we were both, you know, active in Fayette County Democratic Party politics. Mm-hmm. And I know that he has been active for decades in local Democratic Party politics. And so what works to get out the vote next May? Is it going to be putting in your time among the activists and cultivating those relationships that can get out the vote across the 6th district? Or is it, putting together really good campaign ad and splashing onto the national scene in the way that Lieutenant Colonel McGrath did?
Right.
I think it's good for the party to figure those things out, what works.
I agree with you. I think that they're both good candidates, and I think that they both, no matter who comes out of this primary, as long as it's not Jeff Young, is it the third guy that's running?
He's, I have no idea about that. Yeah,
Nick Storm on Pure Politics on CN2, or whatever that show's called, or channel's called now. He interviewed all three people, and I think Jeff Young's he's an interesting guy. But anyways, whichever of these two people comes out of this race, they will pose the biggest threat to Andy Barr of the people who've run against him since he's been an incumbent. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, for sure.
Yeah, and definitely in a midterm election, too. So is there going to be anybody else in that race? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't, I don't have sources. Okay. I just read the news and tell people what I see. So there are several names that have been floated back and forth. Of course, Mayor Jim Gray in Lexington. And I think I've also heard Leslie Combs, former state senator from that area. I'm not quite sure which county she's from. Somewhere east of Lexington. She's not from Lexington, but she's from east of Lexington. And Sandy Overly, I think some people have suggested, might run for that seat. She's the former KDP chair who also serves as in the state legislature. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's still a ways to go before they have to start declaring. But, yeah, that's where we are now. One other interesting thing. Do you think if Reggie Thomas wins this primary, he'll stay in that Senate seat in the Kentucky legislature?
I would think so. I mean, yeah. He's going to be campaigning while the legislature is not in session. There would be no reason for him to need to resign.
That's such a—it's so interesting because I feel like in Louisville, the major Senate districts, except for Morgan McGarvey's, are pretty much never turning over. Like Denise Harper Angel's been there since like 2004, maybe, and I think that maybe she was the last person to turn over in Louisville before that. But that district in Lexington has turned over like 3 times in 10 years because it was Ernesto Scorsone, mm-hmm. and then it was Kathy Stein, and now it's Reggie Thomas. So, you know, a lot more fresh blood coming out of Lexington than Louisville these days. All right, the next thing we have to talk about is Andy Beshear refusing to comply with Matt Bevin's orders. So last week on the show, we talked about Matt Bevin calling for a massive 17% budget cut. If you'll remember, Governor Bevin called for the cuts very early into the fiscal year, which rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, and some people said was illegal. Attorney General Beshear thinks that it is illegal to do these kind of budget cuts because he says that before the consensus forecasting group makes an actual projection that predicts a revenue shortfall, that you can't have these kind of cuts. So in case you didn't know, the consensus forecasting group is the group that, you know, looks at the revenue trends, how much money's coming in from sales taxes, income taxes, et cetera, and says, here's how much revenue that we're going to have, and here's how it's going to fit in with our expense picture. And so far, the consensus forecasting group has only made what's called a preliminary revenue estimate, and that preliminary revenue estimate showed a $200 million shortfall, but it, of course, is only a few months into the fiscal year. Governor Bevin's calling for a massive 17% budget cut based on that shortfall, and it will still be several months before an actual shortfall based on a actual forecast is projected. So to me, this is like the quintessential inside baseball, like people are playing politics. Andy Beshear is refusing to comply with Matt Bevin's orders, which plays to his base. And Matt Bevin is trying to say, oh my gosh, we're in such a mess. I guess at this point, even though he's 2 years into his term, he's still like going to blame Steve Beshear for getting him into this big mess. You know, we have this huge budget problem and we have to do something about our expenses. You know, he's creating this crisis and Andy Beshear is kind of calling him out on it. So who is playing the politics of this situation better?
I don't know the answer to that, Robert. I think that Matt Bevin put out what I read was basically a not compulsory request for what would it look like just roughly.
I think that that's where they landed. I think that they said everybody has to submit budgets, and then a bunch of people came back to them and said, no, that's actually illegal. You can't ask us to do that. And they're like, we weren't asking for budget cuts. We were just saying, just give us a piece of paper that tells us what it would look like.
So that was their response to Andy Beshear citing, you know, the statutes that they were violating.
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily started with Andy Beshear, but yes, he's definitely been a big part of this saying, no, you can't ask us to do that.
Yeah. I think, for me, Andy seems to be winning most of these battles.
In the courts, at least.
In the courts.
Yeah.
And when you're playing politics, or if you're playing politics as the AG, the way you keep score is whether you win in court or not.
Yeah, the only thing that can defeat Andy Beshear is mootness, I think, at this point. I don't think he's I really think that he has not yet lost on the arguments. I don't have the information in front of me, but there were 4 or 5 court cases, and I think a couple of them got thrown out based on mootness because some laws got changed that made, like, looking back, it looks like that you are able to do that now, so Jasmine had to explain to me what mootness was, but now I know.
I'm glad lawyers. Jasmine did it because I'm not sure I could. Okay. But as soon as I said that, though, you know, if you're judging from the politics of it, I guess it really matters whether you're winning with the voters.
Right.
You know, you can win all day in court, but if you're not winning with the voters, then you're not, you know, winning at the game of politics.
Right. Of course, this is the big question facing Kentucky probably for the next 2.5 years or so, which is, you know, Andy Beshear, he's not term limited to attorney general. He can run for another term. This is the first time he has run for any office at all was when he ran for attorney general and won in 2015. And now he has an opponent if he wants to run for attorney general in Whitney Westerfield, friend of the pod. So Whitney Westerfield has declared that he is going to run for attorney general, and he only lost to Andy Beshear by like 250 votes or something.
It
was
very tiny
margin. It was a shockingly small number. So, you know, Andy Beshear, I think, perceives of himself as this important Democratic figure, but, you know, it would be a huge shot if he were to lose re-election to attorney general. So that may give him a reason to move towards running for governor, because losing a race for governor is nowhere near as big a deal as losing a race for attorney general. At least that's how I'm looking at it. So do you think that all this leads up to Andy Beshear running for governor?
I don't know. I mean, you said that he thinks of himself as like an important player in Democratic Party politics.
I don't know him. That's just the way that it seems from where I'm looking at it.
Well, I mean, if you look around, he's the only game in town. Mm-hmm. I mean, he definitely is important because he's the only Democratic, except for Allison Leonard and Grimes.
Which she may very well run for something. Somebody else who was suggested to run for the 6th District congressional seat.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So.
But we sort of need her to vouchsafe our elections in 2018.
We need to get, I don't know what Allison Lindergren Grimes wants to do. We need somebody who's a good Secretary of State.
I agree. So I don't know whether Andy would seek the governorship. I mean, it does make sense if you look at the politics of it and you say, you know, Whitney was running an outsider race, you know, 2 years ago and almost beat me. If I'm going to lose, I better lose against the governor.
Right.
That does make some sense to me, but I think he also likes being AG.
Yeah.
And thinks that role is important. And I think as Kentuckians see Matt Bevin losing in court, think Andy is building up some credibility as the guardrails that Matt Bevin is running into before he runs into a ditch.
Right. Andy Beshear is absolutely keeping his options open. There was that whole situation with Matt Bevin's house. We talked about it on this show at length. But that whole investigation kind of got quashed because one of the ethics panels said, unless the attorney general says he will not run for governor, he can't investigate this. And that was not a step that Andy Beshear was willing to take, which I think he should have. That was just me, though. I thought that we needed somebody to investigate that. And I still think somebody needs to investigate that. There was too much shady stuff going on there that some subgroup that sort of deals with the Louisville PVA's office can't quash the whole thing, which is what ended up happening. Right now, there's nobody left to investigate unless Andy Beshear says he's not running for governor. So he left his options open there for sure.
It seems like, I haven't delved into this, but it seems like there ought to be a provision, if there's not already, to allow Andy Beshear to appoint a Bob Mueller type figure who can independently investigate that. I mean, I know that when Commonwealth attorneys are conflicted out of certain cases, a special prosecutor comes in and prosecutes that case around the Commonwealth. So I don't know why you couldn't appoint a special prosecutor to investigate that particular matter.
Yeah, I don't know either, but that was the way it went. So, the Attorney General's office is not investigating that situation, and they did not appoint a special prosecutor. I don't know what the deal was, but it's been a while since I read that. But
I thought that decision was sort of bogus.
Yeah, it was totally bogus. Yeah. I always try to put myself in if the shoe were on the other foot, you know, if there was a Republican Attorney General and a Democratic Governor, and this seemed like but I do think that if there's enough smoke, somebody should investigate. And the appointment of a special prosecutor, somebody doing some investigation, if there's nothing to hide and you're a public figure, you deserve to, you know, have at least somebody look into it.
Greg Stumbo investigated Ernie Fletcher
for so much. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why the law is the way it is now.
Has the law changed since then?
I don't think so. But I don't know for sure. Seems like if it would have changed, it wouldn't have been under his watch, which, you know, he left the AG's office and then immediately became Speaker of the House. So I don't think he would have passed any of those laws. I don't know. It was the case that it was a unanimous decision, or maybe just one holdout, even though Steve Beshear did have some appointees on that panel. But whatever.
I'm more interested in the question of what kind of politics Matt Bevin is playing in creating the impression that we are besieged by crises, both in our budgets and our pensions. I'm very curious about that because I don't know what the outcome of that is. I mean, I guess it makes good sense if control both houses of the legislature and you're confident that you can get your policy solutions through those houses to create that crisis so that you can, you know, create the scenario where we need to raise taxes on the middle class and cut entitlements or whatever. But at the same time, you know, I'm not so sure that the solutions that Republicans are going to come up with are going to be palatable to Kentucky voters.
And I think that, you know, they have a special session and another General Assembly before they're going to have to own those. And in my opinion, just, you know, I spend a lot of time. I live in Louisville, obviously, which is, you know, one of the two counties that voted Democratic in the presidential election. So it's a lot different than a lot of the rest of the state. But, you know, in my travels to the rest of the state, I do think that the pension issue is the first thing that has really gotten people upset. that there are a lot of people who depend on those state pensions, that either teachers, you know, who are a little bit different because they have a different pension system, but they do depend on those state pensions. Teachers, police officers, firefighters, just state workers, people who work in schools, all of those people really depend on pensions. And you know, releasing something that says you're going to mess with that is probably the first thing I've seen that have really gotten people up in arms about this governorship. Now, he's going to have to own that, but he doesn't have to own it until 2019. So there's still a lot that can be done. I don't know if Matt Bevin is as good at reading the political tea leaves, or he just like kind of, I think the last election, he just kind of, you know, ran in a very fortuitous year and was able to subvert the Republican Party by dividing the base between two other pretty good candidates and coming out of the middle and then facing a opponent who didn't seem like he wanted to be there and becoming the governor. So he has a ways to go before he has to answer for that. And I just don't know what he will do just politically.
Boy, if you think about the 80 votes that Matt Bevin won that primary by,
yeah,
over James Comer,
80 votes,
and the 250 votes that separated Whitney Westerfield and Andy Beshear. If you're out there wondering whether you need to register to vote or vote, these things actually matter.
Yeah.
In a state as small as Kentucky, you know, these tight races, your vote is going to make a difference. And the state would look dramatically different. The rhetoric coming out of Frankfort from a Jamie Comer administration,
yeah,
would be way different than what you see from Matt Bevin.
Yeah, it would sound different. I'm interested to see if it would look different. He definitely does talk. Jamie Comer, who's the first district congressperson now, he does talk with a much more calm and, you know, I would say a better, more diplomatic demeanor, but he's just as conservative as Matt Bevin, at least in the way that he's voted in Washington so far. Okay, let's talk about something different, Ben. We've talked a lot about the many scandals at the University of Louisville here on my Old Kentucky podcast.
I've been following them.
Right. And we actually, Jasmine always says, that's how we started. We started by talking about the U of L board. That was on our first episode, but we've never touched the athletic stuff. And if you aren't conversant in the University of Louisville's athletics program, congratulations. You've managed to avoid, you know, something that seems unavoidable in the state of Kentucky. But if you aren't conversant, the University of Louisville's men's basketball program got in trouble a few years ago when Katina Powell, who is an escort, revealed an arrangement she had with Andre McGee, an assistant coach with U of L, to provide sexual favors to recruits for their basketball team. The NCAA revoked U of L's 2013 national championship banner, which is under appeal, and gave several more sanctions, some of which are kind of in the ether. Nobody really fully understands what they're going to be until the appeals are completed. But now there's more. University of Louisville got in trouble in the midst of an FBI probe in which that alleged that their program paid $100,000 to a recruit. While the FBI didn't name any of the U of L people, it's very clear who they were talking about. And it's likely that the NCAA, even though they did not know about this until yesterday, will open some sort of investigation and there will be more penalties handed down to the University of Louisville. Since U of L is already on probation, their athletics department, because their academics department is also on probation, but their athletics department and their men's basketball program is already on probation because of the Katina Powell situation, the death penalty is on the table as something that might be talked about. People are starting to talk about that, which means for our purposes, we want to leave the athletics aside. If you want to see, want to talk about that, I take it to Twitter or something. But we're talking about state government stuff. This still impacts it because the Yum Center, if the University of Louisville gets the death penalty, it might sit vacant for a whole year. To quote you, Ben, yesterday, only my Old Kentucky podcast would turn criminal bribery into a discussion about municipal bonds, but we need to talk about the bonds. If the Yum Center is vacant, the TIF district won't generate much revenue. In addition, one of the three main prongs of the agreement, U of L Athletics, won't be able to pay much, in addition to the fact that they're facing massive sanctions, which would require them to pay back millions and millions of dollars. So they're going to be in financial trouble. What are we going to do with our arena downtown?
Can we get a sign maker to turn the exclamation mark after yum into like a question mark?
That would cost even more money.
Yeah.
One of the big questions that I have about this whole arrangement, okay? So we talked about this at length starting, you know, in one of our very first shows about the history of the arrangement. There's three prongs to the payment. Metro government in Louisville pays a big chunk of money up front, just a cash payment towards the bonds. The University of Louisville has a lease arrangement, which generates a lot of money for the the bonds, and the state government provided a TIF district. We're not going to get into what that is, but there's plenty of shows that we have about that where you can learn about what a TIF district is. There's three prongs of this arrangement, and they all had to be renegotiated in the past year. And the big holdout was the University of Louisville, because they say, we're good. We don't want anything to change. Now they're in a lot of trouble. I feel like they're going to cling even more tightly to their sweet, sweet arrangement in the lease, and the city and the state are going to be left holding the bag for these massive bond payments with even less money from U of L, maybe.
You know, I haven't read the lease agreement myself, but it seems to me like if Louisville isn't playing games, I would imagine that they're still obligated to make those payments.
Mm-hmm.
And so does that mean that the money is going to come from just the general revenue of the school? And so other
programs are going to be... The athletics department, probably.
The athletics department.
Yeah. And U of L has historically, based on, nobody really has all the books for all the athletics departments in the country, but some analyses have said that the University of Louisville has the most profitable athletics department of any of one in the country.
So maybe they have a rainy day fund that they can use.
They're going to need it already.
Yeah, that they can, continue making those payments. But if they are in the position where they can't play for one or more years at the Yum Center, at some point Louisville is going to have to ask for some sort of change to that lease agreement.
One thing that I do think might happen is so one of the big problems with the lease that a lot of people have pointed out is that the University of Louisville has the right of first refusal for the day of, the day before, and the day after men's and women's basketball games. So there's a lot of dates on the calendar that are just, nope, nobody can go in there. You can't schedule stuff to happen. If they're not happening, there's other events that could pick up the slack. You know what I mean? And I made the suggestion that, I think that if this place is going to sit vacant, which we don't know anything about that yet. There's a long ways to go before that happens. The governor and the mayor should probably get on the phone to the NBA and start doing some sort of arrangement where other teams play home games at the Yum Center. That's something that's happened when the Montreal Expos were about to leave Montreal. They played some home games all the way in like San Juan, Puerto Rico, I think, in Mexico City. And that's something, arrangement that's happened a lot of other places. A lot of the NFL teams play in London sometimes. You can play home games in other arenas, and I think that that's something that we should look into. But yeah, it's just going to open up a bunch of problems if the University of Louisville gets the death penalty. So if you're a UK fan and you're just like shaking with schadenfreude, maybe take a step back and think, this might affect the state government's finances a little bit.
I don't think we shake with schadenfreude. We bathe in it, right?
It could be. Yeah. You have so much schadenfreude, you're actually shaking, or we're just bathing in it.
Yeah.
I feel like if we're bathing in it, we may be drowning in it at this point. Okay. Last thing we want to talk about, I wrote on the show notes, Ben rants about tax liens. So Ben, tell us what we need to know. This is something that's important to you. I've talked to you at length about this before.
Yeah.
But I'm interested. I mean, this is a big issue. You know a lot more about it than we do, and it's an important issue that we need to all learn about. So tell us what we need to know.
So in the state of Kentucky, we tax our property. And the way that we collect those property taxes, in my opinion, has an effect on exacerbating the vacant and abandoned property problem that a lot of our metro areas are dealing with. So one problem we have is that we have somewhere between 6,000 and 11,000 vacant and abandoned properties here in Jefferson County. And we can't afford to maintain all of those properties. The other problem is when we sell our tax debt.
That's what a tax lien is, right?
Yeah. Basically, when the taxes come due, if they're not paid, the city can put a lien on your house for $700 if you don't pay your taxes. What each city in Kentucky does is list all of those delinquent taxes for sale. So you or me or somebody else who is registered can go and buy your neighbor's tax debt for $700, $800. In my opinion, the practice of selling our tax debt is a very damaging practice because it's essentially the fast food of city financing. Because what's happening is, yes, the city is getting that $700 right away, but what you're giving up is worth a lot more than $700.
Right.
You're giving up the opportunity to collect the statutory penalties and interest yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, more crucially, when you sell a tax debt to a third party purchaser, you're usually selling an interest in that property to someone who is either across town or out of state. So you have these companies out of Texas who are investing big bucks in buying delinquent taxes here in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And when they buy that tax lien, they step into the position of the city in terms of
collecting
mm-hmm. and also in terms of priority of payment. So if the house were to go into foreclosure, they enjoy a super priority lien. So they would get paid before even the mortgage company. This puts out-of-state companies in the driver's seat for what happens with individual property. So if there's a property that's vacant and abandoned, but we've sold the tax debt on it, the city doesn't have an interest in that property. Normally, if we kept that tax debt, we would be the lien holders.
Right.
And the county attorney could go in and file a foreclosure after a few years and say, you haven't paid your taxes. We're foreclosing on this piece of property. Mm-hmm. And they can collect the interest, the back due taxes, and then cycle that back into productive use. But when we sell the tax liens, that property can sit vacant for 5, 6, 7, 10 years before a tax lien collector who is getting 12% interest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so they're getting 12% interest. They're getting administrative fees of $115. They're getting pre-litigation attorney's fees up to $750. And then they're getting their regular attorney's fees. So one thing that you'll actually see is attorneys buying tax liens because
they can then be the attorney on the property and they
exactly.
get paid.
Exactly. Yeah. It can be very lucrative. But when we sell those taxes to out-of-state companies or cross-town companies, they're not invested the way that the city is in making sure that the property is foreclosed on quickly, mm-hmm. Responsibly, and cycled back into productive use. And so you all started this podcast talking about university boards. You take every opportunity you can to talk about bonding. And and so this is why I thought this would be a good topic for this podcast, because what other jurisdictions, specifically Michigan, started doing is floating bonds uh-huh. based on the revenue that the city will generate in collecting these delinquent taxes.
Right.
So you go to Wall Street and you say, look, we have $150 million in delinquent taxes that we're going to collect. We know from past experience that 2/3 of these are eventually going to be paid. Mm-hmm. We would like you to give us a loan, float a bond.
Pay for the bond now, and then you pay the bondholders back as the taxes come in. Plus you get extra, as more taxes come in on the property.
Exactly.
Right.
And so when we list these tax debts for sale, we list all of them. Mm-hmm. And third-party purchasers only purchase 1/3 of them. Do you know which third they purchase?
Probably the ones that are most likely to revenue.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So we are privatizing the most profitable part of tax collection.
We're socializing losses and privatizing profits.
That's yes.
Yeah, okay.
Which for anybody who wants to run government like a business is no way to run a business.
Right, right.
It's very frustrating to me that we've been talking to city officials about this, gosh, since 2010, and we've made some progress on the vacant and abandoned property issue, but no progress on creating the kind of political appetite to create the financial structures to float the bond, keep the profitable tax liens mm-hmm. in our portfolio, and then return all of that money that we make, the excess after we pay back the bondholders, back into restoring and rejuvenating vacant and abandoned properties, tearing down the ones that mm-hmm. can't be salvaged, starting apprenticeship programs for people who want to learn how to rehab properties. There's a ton of opportunities that we have to create virtuous cycles in this city around our vacant and abandoned property problem by being real serious about collecting on those mm-hmm. delinquent taxes.
So this is a big problem for Jefferson County, right? But I would assume that it goes beyond just Jefferson County. It would be a problem in many of the cities in Kentucky because it's mostly done this way across the state,
right? It's done this way across the state because we have so much property in Jefferson County. It's pretty bad.
The first show that we had ever had a guest was Attica Scott, who provided a lot of leadership around the vacant and abandoned properties issue when she was on the Metro Council. And since she's left that position, I feel like there hasn't been as much progress made. So, you know, I do hope that the city does take some steps to do this, and I do hope that the rest of the state and the cities across the state take some steps towards doing this, because it is a big problem. Ben's very conversant in it, and you do a much better job of explaining it than I do. But yeah, this is a difficult problem to understand, and I think that's one of the reasons it's so difficult to solve. But yeah, the more that we can learn about it and the more that people understand what's going on, I think that the solutions are pretty straightforward and they work. Do you know if anybody has done any research into the Michigan solution to see if it has produced what they said it was? Are those bonds still rated highly?
Yes, the bonds are rated highly. They perform well. Dan Kildee, who's now a Congress member out of Michigan, sort of started this whole thing in Flint, Michigan.
Right.
And so it is a proven model that has been shown to work in other states. You know, it's a tricky thing because we're talking about big money, but also elected officials, if we do it the way that I'm suggesting, are going to be in an awkward position of, you know, we're asking the county attorney to collect against constituents, sometimes foreclose on constituents. Mm-hmm. And you know, frankly, I think it just seems cleaner to elected officials to leave the dirty work to
somebody who doesn't have to stand for election.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And get the money right up front. But that's the easy way out here, in my opinion. And I think it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of hard work to get this right.
I mean, blighted and abandoned properties are tough for neighbors. And I mean, for every one of those that you foreclose upon from somebody out of town, like you probably, you know, there's two neighbors on either side that are probably happy with you, even if that one person's mad at you.
Yeah. The metaphor that I think is really appropriate here is if you imagine houses in foreclosure and vacant and abandoned properties as houses that are on fire, the fire doesn't just affect that property. It affects the neighboring properties as well. So when I heard Mayor Fisher on your program say that the single most pressing social problem of our time was lack of social mobility,
right?
That's all tied up to me in the problem of vacant and abandoned properties, because the big wealth gap, the thing that drives the wealth gap between African-American families and white families who make the same amount of money, is the lack of equity in their homes.
Yeah, home ownership rates. Absolutely.
And so the more we can do in our neighborhoods to make sure that African-American neighborhoods appreciate and value as quickly as white neighborhoods, if not more quickly, and make sure that African-Americans are getting access to credit in responsible, non-predatory ways, that's really going to be a big driver across generations to making sure that those families have the same access to credit. You know, for a lot of people, the equity in their homes is the cushion that saves them when
something happens.
Mm-hmm. They can get a home equity line of credit. They already have a home equity line of credit, and they can replace that car that failed, so they keep that job rather than losing the job.
Right.
And so there's a real virtuous cycle that comes from this.
Right. Yeah. And we didn't even get into how much the city has to pay to maintain these vacant and abandoned properties, and there's cost in addition to additional revenue, et cetera. But, you know, we're over time, so we can't talk about that. But if people want more information about this issue, where can they go to learn about it?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a link to the Metropolitan Housing Coalition's monthly vacant property campaigns meeting. They have a meeting once every month about issues relating to vacant and abandoned properties. They've been doing it for a number of years. Kathy Hinko is the domain expert in this area. And just a quick shout out to the city for one thing that they're doing right. They've been much more aggressive in putting IPL, inspections, permits, and licensing, and code violation and maintenance liens on properties. And that can give the city an interest in property that they've lost by the sale of these things.
Right.
So that's been something the Mayor Fisher has done really well, and they're doing a good job of making sure that the city is being reimbursed for the work that they are doing to maintain those properties.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Ben. We really appreciate that.
My pleasure. You're going to go over time every time you ask me to come on, so yeah. I appreciate it.
And also, thank you for letting us record in your space.
Of course.
You know, I say thank you. I try to say thank you a lot, but, you know, you're here, and I'm telling everybody thank you in front of all of them. All right. If you would like to know more about My Old Kentucky Podcast, you can like us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at My Old KY Pod, and you can listen to us by subscribing in any podcasting app of your choice. Thank you very much for listening this week, and we will see you again next week.